Hello, and welcome to the Open Systems Media webcast titled Embedded Signal Processing for Military ISR Sensor Systems. My name is John McHale, Group Editorial Director with Military Embedded Systems and moderator for today's event. Our speakers today are Noah Donaldson, Chief Technology Officer with Annapolis Microsystems, Tammy Carter, Senior Product Manager for GP, GPUs, and Software at Curtiss-Wright Defense Solutions, and Steve Goodconnect, Product Manager for Embedded Computing Products at Elma Electronic. Now for some short bios of our speakers. Noah, as mentioned, is the CTO at Annapolis Micro. He has earned a business BS in physics from Carnegie Mellon University. In 1995, he started at Annapolis as an intern, eventually worked on high-performance FPGA boards and mezzanine cards, developing some of the first greater than 1.0 GSPS multi-channel Cygnus digital receivers. Today, Noah oversees all product development and business development for Annapolis. Tammy Carter is, as mentioned, Senior Product Manager for GP, GPUs, and Software Products, where she features OpenHPEC, or High Performance Embedded Computing, for Curtiss-Wright Defense Solutions. In addition to an MS in computer science, she has more than 20 years of experience in designing, developing, integrating real-time embedded systems in the defense, communication, and medical arenas. Lastly, Steve Goodconnect, Product Manager at Embedded Computing Products at Elma, where he's held positions that include field applications and marketing in the high-tech industry for more than 25 years. His responsibilities include many phases of product development, marketing, and sales support, with a special focus on storage and networking products. Our sponsors for today's event are Annapolis Microsystems, Curtiss-Wright Defense Solutions, and Elma Electronic. And now for some short housekeeping announcements. This and all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. Today's webcast will consume about 40 to 45 minutes, leaving the remaining time for the question and answer session. And I want to point out some important buttons on your screen. First, please take note of the Enlarge Slides button. By clicking on this button, you'll be able to view the slides in full screen mode. You can use the Download Slide button to view the slides as a PDF to see them larger. The next button I want you to look at is the Forward to a Friend button, which enables you to email a friend to register for this event. The last important button on your screen allows you to enter questions in real time. We'll do our best to address these questions during the closing Q&A session. During that session, if you have a question intended for a specific speaker, please note so at the beginning of your question. Otherwise, I'll hand out the questions equally to all our speakers. If you have a question pertaining to the webcast operation itself, one of our technicians will respond back to you during the webcast. Please note that as much as we'd like to, we may not get to all of your questions today. In that case, someone may get back to you after the webcast with more information. This webcast will be archived online and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. Now, to start the presentation, I'm going to turn it over to Noah Donaldson. Noah, take it away.
Thanks very much, John, and I'd like to thank Open Systems Media as well for organizing this event. When it was mentioned that you were going to talk about have an event about embedded signal processing for the ISR sensor systems, I started thinking about ISR and how it relates to sort of multifunction sensors and how that's there are now many sensors being placed on platforms, and many of those sensors can, do multifunctions from radar to comms to SIGINT processing. So I thought that it'd be best to start talking about, one aspect of those sensors is that those sensors are typically phased array sensors. So they have multiple antennas on them, and you do beamforming processing in order to process the data that you're either receiving or the signals that you're transmitting through those sensors. So more and more, these types of phased array sensors are being used. So they're being used on multiple platforms, from airborne platforms, which we're going to talk through a little example of. But they're, of course, used on, shipborne platforms, underwater, land, fixed platforms, essentially everywhere. So one of the biggest challenges with these types of sensors is doing the beamforming, which, many of our customers are, doing using digital beamforming techniques nowadays. And those are typically based on FPGA processing to do that beamforming. So we together with our customers sort of come up with some solutions for those types of problems. So the problems typically associated with doing this is a need for real-time digitization of the data using synchronized ADC and DAC channels. Often nowadays the sensors are getting larger or the arrays are getting larger, so it can be hundreds or thousands of ADC and or DAC channels that have to be synchronized. Next, you have to process that data in real time. That processing can involve the beamforming processing of receiving the data, essentially adding signals together and passing it down the line in a low latency manner. But then there can also be follow-on processing of maybe channelization, encryption, things like that. Lastly, one might also want to record that data in order to look at it later. So we, like I said, together with our customers, have come up with some solutions around these challenges. And all of these solutions are sort of based on a 100 gigabit Ethernet COTS ecosystem. So what we did was we came up with a set of chassis and backplanes as well as plug-in modules that can be used to process the beamforming data. One of the backbones to this backplane is the RT3 connector from TE Connectivity. It's a relatively new connector just coming out on the market. Unlike the previous RT2 connectors, these connectors are now capable of 25 gigabit signaling per high-speed serial lane, which gives you a 100 gigabit Ethernet capable fat pipe on the data plane. In addition, if you need additional sort of scalability and bandwidth on your system, you also have the option of adding things like optical I/O to this system. To get into a little more detail on how this works, here you can see the diagram of a 100 gigabit beamforming backplane. This particular backplane is designed for, really could be used for any type of application, but it's a relatively large system. It has 10 processing payload slots, and so that means that it has a lot of capability. It's designed to go into a 19-inch type of rack. So the leftmost and rightmost slots are power supply slots. So you have four of those slots, which can deliver up to 4,000 watts for this chassis. Then there are the 10 payload slots where the majority of the processing is done. There's a clock slot, which is slot 9. Now the clock slot provides, so you can plug in a position, navigation, and timing module into this slot, and that'll provide those things, navigation, timing, and position, as well as synchronization. So over the radial clock plane, which are the red boxes about two-thirds of the way down the diagram, this clock board can provide synchronization signals over ref clock and aux clock. On the OpenVPX backplane, the synchronization signals can be used to synchronize multiple payload cards and mezzanine cards on those payload cards so that your ADCs and DACs are all synchronized. And then the next slot is the slot 8, which is an Ethernet switch slot. And that's where one could plug in a 40 gigabit Ethernet switch or a 100 gigabit Ethernet switch. And then over the data plane, which are the teal colored connections, each of those connections could run at up to 100 gigabit Ethernet. Now, one of the things that makes this backplane particularly suitable for beamforming are these adjacent slot-to-slot connections that you have over that data plane. Those can be used for a low-latency connection so that, you know, to optimize your beamforming processing between FPGA cards, which are plugged into the payload slots. So between those sort of slot-to-slot connections and the radial clocking, you end up with a system that's, you know, optimized for channel synchronization as well as processing of data in a beamforming type of architecture. Some of the types of products that could be in here, you know, here's an FPGA processing product. So the yellow blocks on here are connectors where you see the OpenVPX connector on the bottom and mezzanine card connectors on the left side of the screen. The red boxes are the FPGAs, so the left two FPGAs are the main signal processing FPGAs, while the one on the right is the host processing FPGA, so it's a Zynq processor with an ARM core embedded so that it can run Linux or VxWorks and host the entire board so that each board can be hosted independently. There's also DRAM included both on the board, and there's essentially SRAM internal to the FPGAs, SRAM-like functionality internal to the FPGAs. And the mezzanine card sites are very high bandwidth mezzanine card sites so that you can plug in high-density ADC and DAC mezzanine cards in order to be able to achieve the digital beamforming type of requirements that you have. Lastly, there's Vita 66 and 67 connectors on the backplane where so that you can do blind mate connectivity of either coax, RF, or optical connections. There are switch slots in this chassis. So here's an example of a 100 gigabit Ethernet switch that can be plugged into the chassis. Each of the gray arrows pointing to the backplane slot on the right are showing a 100 gigabit Ethernet connection to the backplane, and all of the connectors on the left are showing the SFP and MPO optical connectors, which could run anywhere from 1 gigabit up to 100 gigabit. The a bit more data about the FPGA processing card. You can see some of the temperature ranges on this card. So it's a minus 55 to plus 85 C operating range. So this is a very broad temperature range card. Some mezzanine cards that can be used are this 8-channel ADC 3 gigahertz mezzanine card, and our GM60 card, which uses Xilinx's RF SoC Zynq processor. So this processor has an ARM core FPGA processing, as well as we're using in this case 4 ADC channels and 4 DAC channels, which are running at 4 gigasample and 6.4 gigasamples. So you have a very high density receive and transmit solution here, which is perfect for radar and EW anytime you have this type of phased array. Finally, I mentioned that one might have a need for storage. So customers are employing our storage solution both in 6U and 3U, which uses solid state storage drives over an NVMe type of PCIe bus connection, In 6U format, this is available in up to 128 terabytes of storage depth and 14 gigabytes per second of bandwidth. So it's a very high performance, high depth, high density solution for this OpenVPX space. Here's an image of the chassis, you know, one of the chassis that is associated with this backplane. So, you know, this would typically be used in an airborne type of application for us, or maybe shipboard. You can see it's an air-cooled chassis designed for rugged applications. There are also smaller sensors, of course, for smaller platforms. There are other types of solutions that customers are looking to achieve. In those cases, there are smaller chassis, things like we have an RF SoC brick solution, which is about a 1-inch by 4-inch by 5-inch metal brick, which has multiple receive and transmit channels, as well as storage for UAV types of applications and things like that. Pretty much wraps it up for me, and we can go back to you, John. Thank you.
Thanks, Noah. Good presentation, and please keep those questions coming in. After our third and final speaker, we will start our Q&A. And now for our second speaker, Tammy Carter of Curtiss-Wright Defense Solutions. Tammy, the stage is yours.
Thank you, John, and good afternoon, everyone. So let's start talking about, are you getting the best performance out of your signal processor? Your hardware may be ready, but is your software? The hardware components of your system is in place. For 3U OpenVPX systems, we now have CPU cards with peak performance of up to 650 gigaflops and GPUs capable of 6.2 teraflops, all connected by Gen 3 PCIe. On 6U VPX systems, the CPUs can deliver peak performance of 1.4 teraflops per card and 12.4 teraflops for GPU cards. Backplanes of the 6U systems can support either 40 gig Ethernet or InfiniBand now. But how well is your code actually performing on this hardware? We've seen cases where the software only runs at 6 to 10% efficiency. Can you be more efficient? Have you looked at your tools lately? Or are you still using the traditional embedded tools, such as VxWorks or hardware vendors' tools? Are you using the printf statement or logging to debug and optimize your code? Yes, in our previous generations of embedded systems, most of us could solve any problems with a printout, but times have changed. Usually our applications will start as serial code, either from code we use from a previous program or from a MATLAB simulation written by the systems guys. But when we port it to our embedded systems with multi-core processors and multiple boards, we must balance the processing I/O and memory by finding the sweet spot between the task and the threads. So there are multiple options to look at for parallel software development tools. I'm going to briefly cover some of them. This chart shows the options from the lowest level to the highest level, where the lowest level you can think of like assembly language and the highest level you think of like a C++ or a higher language. Most of these options have evolved from the original P threads, which was C-based. The C+ and the Boost threads is a C++ class library with similar functionalities. Both of these tend to be lower level, they are very flexible, and they'll give you the best control. But the downside is that they require a steep learning code, a great effort to scale up to multiple processors and to achieve your desired performance. And neither one of them translates to GPUs. The next circle is the Intel TVB, which is the thread building blocks. It is a C++ template library that you can use on Intel, ARM, or Power architecture. It gives the programmer direct control of the parallelization, but hides the resource management. TVB can be hard to plug into existing code and has a steep learning curve, but it offers you the best control. Now then, OpenMP and OpenACC are both Pragma-based compiler extensions that work for both CPUs and GPUs. They both have a unified code base for both the serial and the parallel application, which simplifies testing and debugging. Because really, if you code is working in the serial, it should also work in the parallel, and then you can see if you broke it by adding statements. So by being able to also work at one section of the code at the time, these tools enable you to do your parallelism by incremental steps. The top level is MPI, the message passing interface, whose goal is to hide the underlying communication mechanisms without sacrificing performance. Unlike the other tools on this chart, it works on both distributed and shared memory applications. The parallelism in the MPI is implicit. The user must identify how the parallel code and then implement it. The performance is related directly to the communication method beneath the nodes, such as the Ethernet, the PCIe, etc. But when you go to parallel your code, there are potential issues and pitfalls. First touch memory. Memory is allocated when you first use it, not when you allocate it. So you need to be aware which thread you initialize your memory. Fault sharing. Threads can impact the performance of each other while modifying even independent variables because they are on the same cache line. Waste conditions, which can lead to deadlocks and other conditions. Cache locality. Well, think about when you have a big data cube, say with like, you know, the rows and the columns. When you walk through the cube in the rows, everything is fine, but when you start stepping through columns, then basically you're going to be striding and you will step out of the cache lines and you'll have to refresh, which will cost you time. The next one is processor and thread affinity. I'm actually going to show you an example of that later. And then, of course, scalability, how to scale up to more processors for longer ranges, etc. So to get started, let's look at a profiler. I'm calling it an HPC profiler because one of the things I think is a solution to our space is using tools from the high-performance computer world. And you're saying, well, what is the high-performance computer world? That is simply just from the supercomputer world. So here is a profiler from the supercomputer world. And you can see it looks pretty much like a lot of debuggers and profilers you're probably used to. It has a metric view, so you can see where you can look at the computational information, the communication, and the I/O communication. Of course, you can see your source code, your call stack, what instruction you operate in, and then in section 5, you can actually see the line of code that you should concentrate on that's taking the most time in your application. So let's use this profiler to look at a simple code example. For this test, I have chosen to do Pi. It's written in C, and all these tests that you'll be seeing in the next couple of slides have been run on one of our Intel Xeon D 8-core processors in a 6U OpenVPX system. So you can see the code's very simple. We run the code. If you look at the results, you can see that this program executed in 30.6 seconds, and 100% of the time was spent in a single-thread computation, which is as expected. Okay, so now let's take the next step, and let's optimize it. So I'm going to optimize it using the OpenMP. Remember, OpenMP provides an abstraction layer to hide the complexity of creating and killing threads as well as managing work synchronization. In this example, I'm just going to use two threads to keep it simple. And now if we look at the construct of what I did with the OpenMP, the parallel keyword tells you that each thread will redundantly execute the same code, while the for keyword is a work share construct that will split the loop's iterations across the threads. One of the challenges then when you do parallelization is to make that each loop independent so that they can execute safely in any order. And in our example, sum is a dependence between each loop iteration. And this is a common situation, and it is known as a reduction. In this case, a local copy will be made of the sum variable, and it will be initialized to zero. That is signified by the plus sign. The local copies will then each update the temporary copy of sum and then combine it back together for the final answer. Okay, so now if you look at the output of the profiler, you can see that the code is indeed using two threads, and as expected, the time drops in half to 17.8 seconds. Also notice that the OpenMP overhead is just 0.01% of the total time, and the CPU floating point utilization rose from 78.7% to 83.4% between the first and second run. Okay, it's like, well, can I do better? So let's add the MPI on top of it, which is real common. You can combine one of those lower level examples from that chart I showed you earlier with MPI to get more bang for your buck. So we want to be able to use the MPI to break the loop into for loop into different pieces. So each of the for loops will work on a different set of iterations. So for this particular test, I have broken it up into two processes, which for the example, I'm running on the same processor, but in reality, it could actually be on two separate processors, of course. So basically, each process will work on half the loops in the for loop. Okay, so we compile and run that, and wow, my timing is still at 17 seconds. What went wrong? You would expect it to be roughly half again. Well, if you look at what the profile is trying to tell us, the CPU time should be near 100%, but it is around 50%. Also, the number of involuntary context switches is extremely high. A large number of involuntary context switches can create an indication that something is going wrong with the processes and they are being switched between processes, and the low CPU confirmed this. Okay, so how do we fix this, or what actually went wrong? Well, if you look at the MPI documentation, you will find that if a program is combining MPI and OpenMP, or for that matter, any other multi-threading technique, the process infinity needs to be disabled. It is always enabled by a default, and processor affinity is also known as CPU pinning, which will bind all the threads to one on the same core, basically negating any of the benefits you were trying to achieve by running the MPI. So let's disable that and run it again. So after we run it again, you can see that we are now at our expected runtime of 7 seconds. So the important thing is we now have proven that our application is scalable across multiple cores and multiple processes. So the next step would be simply easy to do it across 4 instead of 2. And you could continue to take the time down until the necessary timing is achieved. So let's take this from a simple example to a real-world results. This is from a study that we took part in where we was given a serial benchmark code that was representative of SAW and MTI. The first day after we had the code, we had it up and running on our embedded hardware using our HPC tools. And as you can look at the tables for both the SAW and GMTI, you can see the top individual performance optimizations that was made for both modes. So I think as you look through these numbers, you'll see that this study clearly demonstrated the power that the right tools can give you for rapid prototyping and optimization. So why would you want to use the HPC tools in the embedded systems? You just saw some examples. The important thing about using these tools is a lot of the tools we have used in the past has been board-level tools, where these actually provide a system-level integration and testing the software at a system level. As you can see, they're really good at board level, but they really shine when you're working on the system levels. And because they are from the supercomputer world, they have a much larger user base. So that means you have a more mature tool, and it also means that you have more people that know the tool, so it's easy to get programmers to work on your systems. And these tools are based on open standards, which means you have portability across your platforms and programs, which provides greater code reuse, and also means you don't have to relearn a new tool on every program. And face it, if you can get your software more efficient, you can help your SWAP-C. This is achieved by the more efficient your software is, you could maybe, you know, do with fewer boards in your systems, which will reduce your size, weight, and power. Your more efficient software means your boards can work cooler, and it improves your mean time between failures. So I know a lot of people will spend the money on the tools to develop hardware, but, you know, it's kind of hard to get you to develop to spend the money on the software tools. But think about it. You wouldn't develop hardware without the proper tools. Why are you trying to develop software without the proper tools? So let me introduce you to our OpenHPEC tool suite. And you can see what I have demonstrated earlier briefly was the profiler. There's a debugger that goes with it that basically debugs OpenMP, OpenACC, GPUs, CPUs, memory. I mean, you name it, this thing can debug it. And then we also have cluster managers, math libraries. We have optimized PCIe communications. Together, this whole set makes an extremely important set of tools to help you develop your software in a timely manner and get it to the most efficient running software that you can possibly achieve. And at that, I'm at the end of my presentation. Thank you for listening to me. And now back to John.
Thanks, Tammy. Excellent job. And once again, please get your questions in. And then after our next speaker, we're going to start our Q&A. So keep those questions coming in. And now for our very our anchor speaker, Steve Goodconnect of Elma. Steve, take it away.
Well, thank you, John. Thank you for that introduction. Tammy, you provided me with a good segue there. You said that why would you pay less attention to hardware than you do software? And I think one of the things that I wanted to talk about is hardware development tools. So thank you for kind of paving the way here. Elma's role in the realization of ISR equipment in defense is somewhat different, and I would say complementary, from what we just heard from my colleagues at Annapolis and Curtis Wright. At Elma, we're more focused on the underlying foundational hardware infrastructure needed to enable the development of the deployed system. Elma provides a springboard development system infrastructure through to the complete and fully tested and integrated deployable end-use systems, including application-specific payloads. VPX system design is a ground-up affair, and it requires a holistic approach that considers not only the steps in the process, but the end target as well. So while that's always been the case in embedded systems design, what we're all finding out here is that in VPX, the holistic approach is even more important. Couple this with the fact that VPX is continuing to evolve at a fast pace, and that system design can be a moving target when it comes to module selection, including the SBCs, Ethernet switches, network timing cards, storage cards, and payload cards. Life can get pretty complicated. So that's why it's important that designers lay a solid system foundation while paying close attention to emerging specifications and their impact. We're working with a supplier who can do that for you. So let's get started. More building blocks. It's a little cliche at this point, but I think it's an effective model for drawing attention to important aspects of a complex topic. So in creating that foundational VPX system, we need to consider a few items. Development backplanes, development chassis are the key place to start in system design. Development chassis and backplanes are vehicles to enable the identification of modules, modules with profiles appropriate to the application. And these would fall under the auspices of VITA, SOSA, CMOS standards. A little bit more on that later. From there, module identification and the all-important signal path determination ultimately leads to the deployment backplane. Initial development efforts with a development backplane are intended to lead to a narrowing in the selection of the necessary boards or modules and their profiles. And then the deployment backplane design begins to emerge, which leads to the actual final backplane. We'll see how this comes about shortly, and that's a major step in VPX system realization, the all-important backplane identification. System integration. Of the foundational board set, and that again would be the SBCs, networking, storage, and timing, leading to the application development, with application development in Elma's case typically performed by customers or partners such as Annapolis Micro and Curtis Wright. In terms of complete thermal analysis leading to the final design of the deployed chassis, taking into consideration every operational and environmental aspect of the payload in its end-use installation. And all this culminates into the final deployable chassis. John, that's not the right slide. That's interesting. Okay. That somehow, that previous slide was not the right slide. Anyway, let's carry on. So the path towards realization is supported by those basic steps, which was the wrong slide, interestingly enough. So on to slide four. So no discussion of VPX development would be complete without mention of the current evolution of VITA standards. I'm talking about a hardware convergence initiative driven by the Department of Defense and CERDEC. The initiative is intended to enable the integrated development of common modular hardware architectures in C4ISR and electronic warfare systems across the three branches of the armed forces. Multi-vendor interoperability is also a key goal of the set of standards now known as CMOS, or C4ISR Modular Open Suite of Standards. Among that suite of standards, SOSA, or Sensor Open Systems Architecture, defines the module and slot profiles for the various board types used. Emerging VPX modules adhering to SOSA are understood to have SOSA profiles. So what does all this mean? Let's go a little bit of background. Around about 2012-2013, VITA 46 emerged as a follow-on to VME as a point-to-point serial architecture. VPX was born. And VPX was developed to boost the data rates in systems for high-speed ISR systems. Problem was the module profile definitions, the new term for connector pinouts, were too broad, and the result was no commonality between vendors of the same board type and tremendous problems for integrators attempting to get boards to cooperate with each other across the backplane. VITA 65 brought with it a further narrowing of the various definitions in the hopes of addressing these issues. The user community and the integrators said close, but not close enough. This led to the advent of what we refer to now as the CMOS initiative, with the goals being as follows: multi-vendor interoperability, tri-branch adoption of common board types, the enhanced hardware convergence capability, and also a reduced number of module profiles. So you can consider SOSA or CMOS directives and the profiles they drive to be simply a subset of VPX. And these are some samples of the deployed backplane you'll see on the right-hand side. Okay, so getting back to system realization, whether the system at hand will include SOSA CMOS module profiles or not, the development path is the same, and in VPX it starts with the backplane. ELMA provides development backplanes which support a sampling of current SOSA module profiles. The backplane you see on the left is a 12 slot plus two PSU slots for power supply, the CMOS development backplane supplied by ELMA. The backplane serves as a development base for determining the specific modules and their related slot profiles needed for the end application. The result of that development effort is the definition of the deployment backplane, which contains only the slot profiles necessary for the modules needed by the application. Concurrently, slot-to-slot backplane connectivity is determined, and the resulting topology leads to the design of the deployment backplane. Now, on the right, you'll see some examples of deployed backplanes that could likely be developed from the CMOS development backplane. And by way of easing the development effort, a solid tabletop open access chassis provides the elbow room for design activities. An integrator can use the development platform as a tool both for early integration activities as well as application development activities. Populating the chassis with VPX SOSA Foundation modules, again SBC, Ethernet switching, storage, and so forth, and VITA 62 plug-in power supplies brings together a full development environment that can be used to address multiple programs. The backplane, as we'll see, provides a selection of payload slots for IP related to the end application. A quick snapshot of the backplane here shows the various slot profiles supported, many of which we saw on slide 6, the Vita SOSA aligned slot profiles. Essentially, slots 4, 5, 8, and 9 are dedicated to the application-specific payload I/O for a given application. The remaining slots make up that foundational board set, which will include the functional bones of the system. The final deployment backplanes may have as few as 2 slots or as many as 12 slots plus 2 slots for power supply. And as an important side note, and I think Tammy mentioned it earlier, rather Noah, several new module profiles, as you may have already noticed, include RF and optical connectivity in accordance with Vita 67.3, but that's a topic for a different webcast. So bringing it all together, chassis selection is really the culminating point resulting from all of the earlier development activities. When we consider the data rates and the processing speeds and resultant power dissipation from emerging board types, chassis design is critical. In terms of thermal considerations, Vita 48 and its underlying set of standards address several methods of air flow through cooling, liquid flow through cooling, and conduction cooling, all to deal with high dissipated power levels. Chassis should be capable of ensuring payloads remain below their defined operational temperature at all times. Intelligent power systems and overall system management solutions, including Vita 46.11 intelligent platform management schemes, enable the system to operate at an optimal level while end users can keep an eye out for problems and alerts to maintain system uptime. I/O requirements include the custom design, selection, and configuration of the I/O panel. Connectors need to be selected to perform in the end-use environment, and they need to support new and anticipated data rates with fail-proof signal integrity. So wrapping it up with the current state of the technology, 25 gigabit data rates, backplane data rates are on their way, as we've heard. If you think signal integrity was a hot topic now, it's going to be getting hotter going into the future. It's important to really zero in on an experienced backplane provider, backplane designers, because the backplane is literally the backbone of VPX functionality, and signal integrity is at the heart of that. New high-density 67.3 connectors we mentioned. Higher density in these connectors means tightly packed RF connections. It means less heat dissipated compared to copper and lesser density Vita 67 connectors. New development backplanes supporting the newly developed modules. As time goes by, Vita and SOSA and the various committees will be defining and continue to define new module profiles. That means that new development backplanes will need to be created. And so that's an ongoing activity. I may not have mentioned this earlier, but new module profiles address 6U as well as 3U board form factors, as many applications will require the extended I/O capability of 6U for sure. Hybrid Ethernet and PCIe switching profiles. Emerging VPX and SOSA switch profiles will support both hybrid switches and for Ethernet and multi-domain PCIe connectivity. And lastly, as I mentioned, intelligent Vita 62 power supplies and intelligent chassis management improvements are on the way to address new system densities anticipated. So to conclude, high-speed signal processing system realization is an arduous process by any measure. It's important to use reliable, proven development tools in defining, designing, and building mission-critical systems for ISR and other high-speed signal applications in defense installations. It's advantageous to work with suppliers who can assist in the process from start to finish and who can provide the continuity of an uninterrupted path from early development activities to delivery of the final deployment hardware. Thanks, and over to you, John.
Thanks, Steve. Good presentation. I'm going to get the Q&A started with a quick follow-up to your SOSA slides. I know companies are developing products with meet the SOSA specs and such. Are you seeing requirements from the government for SOSA-compliant hardware yet? Is it spelled out? I'm just curious if it was spelled out in requirements at all for the military.
John, is that a question for me?
That's for you. I was following up with you, Steve. Yeah, it's for you.
Oh, sorry.
Okay. Or Tammy wants to answer it. Yeah.
Yes, we are. There's sort of some angst in the community about how to define and how to refer to these modules. But in fact, we are getting de facto calls for systems that enable and include profiles as defined by SOSA and those emerging standards activities. So the answer is yes.
Okay, thanks. Next question is for Tammy. Tammy, how does hyper-threading affect optimization?
Well, for a quick definition of hyper-threading, it is something that's available on Intel processors, and it allows a single processor to act like two separate processors to the OS and the application. And it is very useful when you have compute-bound problems, but it actually is detrimental if you have it turned on if you have I/O-bound problems, so it's very important to know whether your application is compute or I/O-bound.
Okay. Next question is for Noah. Noah, what are some approaches in ISR to move the processing closer to the sensor to deal with all those tricky bandwidth challenges?
Yeah. So a lot of platforms do have would be desirable to move that some of that processing closer to the sensor and have fiber optic links back to another, a more central location for further processing. So some of those techniques are using things like RFSOC just data converters together with optical transceivers, smaller power, wider temperature range type of solutions that you put close to the sensor and then send optical back to, a more centralized location for further processing. Mostly using optical solutions.
Okay. And kind of as a follow-up, I have another question here from the audience. The Xilinx, you mentioned the RFSOC device. You mentioned it in your presentation. It's being leveraged for EW applications. It's really jumped out in front. And I know myself, I was at the Association of Little Crows show last year, which is very focused on electronic warfare, and that's all everybody was talking about was that coming release. But what about Intel, and are they going to provide a similar device from their Altera pedigree of products? Do you still get requests from customers for their FPGAs?
We do still get requests for Intel PSG, that's their Programmable Solutions Group, so it's for Altera. We do still get requests for those. And as for data converter-like solutions from them. I think it's possible that they may have some of those coming out. It's probably best to ask them, though, I would think.
They would, though. Hopefully they'll know.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, next question from the audience. This one's for Steve. What do you see as some key points for end users and system designers to be aware of in the currently evolving VPX standard?
I think overall, as a supplier and in my position as a supplier and also in position from a customer, I would think that what we need to do is be vigilant and be informed as to what's going on in the standards committee so that we can be aware of it. As a supplier, there will be some expectation that suppliers to the defense industry will begin developing, if they have not already begun developing, modules with profiles that adhere to the new emerging standards. And so there's an implication that as a supplier, certainly, first and foremost, you'll want to be aware of that, and certainly as a customer, to be able to take advantage of that. So I think staying informed is the key point.
Okay. Next question for Tammy. Which is better, OpenMP or OpenACC?
Well, that's an interesting debate, and the answer is probably it depends on what you are planning to do with it. OpenACC is a little stronger for GPUs, while OpenMP is a little bit stronger for multi-core processors. It's also the philosophy is a little different. where OpenACC, they treat the programmer as smart, but the compiler is smarter, and it can become smarter with even a little help, where OpenMP kind of assumes that the compiler is dumb and the programmer is smart. So one of the problems with OpenMP is, as you can see, you basically just add a pound pragma, and if something goes wrong, you can end up with having your code run very fast but give the incorrect answer, hence the need for the tools and all. But OpenACC is, you know, supported by just a few compilers, where OpenMP is supported by lots more. So a lot of it depends on your case and your application.
Okay. Next question. This one's for Noah. Do you have any thoughts regarding the Reflex Photonics versus Firefly for fiber connections?
Well, we're using the Firefly on most of our products. It seemed to be a good solution in terms of they're going to be coming out with 25 gig, which at 4X is 100 gig transceivers quite soon, and you often have good temperature ranges available, including I-10. So we aren't opposed to other vendors. In fact, we often will survey our customers and see if they have significant experience or desire for one or the other. But right now, we're using mostly the Firefly transceivers.
Okay. Next question from the audience. This one's sort of general, and it's whoever wants to take it. This person is asking, they are focusing on the ISR target segment, and they were curious about what are some programs and platforms and real-world target applications that these technologies and techniques are being used for that were covered in the presentation. I think we mentioned their use for electronic warfare and radar, but if you could maybe specify some of the functions that they perform without giving away secrets. Who would like to take that? Tammy, you want that one?
Okay, I will take a shot at that one. The software, the development tools are good for just about any development. As you can see from the example that we gave was obviously a radar example with MTI and SAR, but we've also had it for video applications, for EAW. It's pretty broad spectrum because anything that has software in it, these tools will apply and help you get, because the whole key in our business is the latency and throughput. And that's what we all strive to get the best of.
Anybody else want to speak to that question? Steve or Noah?
Some of the target applications, very generically, like you said, EW radar. We'll, of course, see SIGINT, synthetic aperture radar as well, anything along those lines. I guess, you can probably Google and find the types of programs and platforms that might be, that might be using sort of technology.
Probably okay. All right. Next question from the audience. And this one's for Steve. Steve, VPX is dominating the market, as you've made clear, for signal processing in the military. Do you see any requests for compact PCI serial for military applications? I remember reading somewhere where you guys did have a successful design in of that.
Yeah, it's interesting. We have seen an uptick. I mean, this is from a very low level of business, let's say, so it's not a major in an absolute sense. In a relative sense, we are seeing a decent uptick in interest in CPCI serial, and we believe it's because it's been around for some time, so it's got some pedigree to it. It's got pretty respectable data rate capacity, 12 gigabits per second. It doesn't have quite the rugged exposure as VPX, but we think that there's some appeal to it because it has been around for some time now. It's got proven track record. It's at a lower cost point than VPX. So, yes, we have seen an increase in CPCI serial. In fact, we're trying to take advantage of that as we go along. So, yes, we have seen a definite uptick in CPCI serial for sure.
Okay. Next question. This one's for Tammy. Tammy, how many boards do you need in your system to consider using all these tools in your presentation, I'm assuming?
Well, for the OpenHPEC Accelerator Suite, the rule of thumb that I usually use is usually four boards on a 3U VPX system and three boards on a 6U VPX system. But we have found out, because I had some people disappointed because they really liked the tools and wanted to use them, so we have a subset of tools called OpenHPEC LX that are for 1 and 2 board systems.
Okay. And Tammy, I got a question for you. Based on something Steve said, it occurred to me when he's talking about compact PCI serial being around a bit and VPX and it's a little lower priced. I've been to many European defense electronics events where for a while VPX, they say they like it, but it's so expensive. And now they're saying, I like it, it's too expensive, but it's the only thing that does what it does, so I guess I got to buy it. And do you see more acceptance of VPX, more install-ins for VPX globally outside of U.S. military applications? You guys are cool.
We are seeing some of the open VPX. We still see a lot of 3U systems, and it is still VPX, but they tend to go for the PCIe because it is smaller and it is less expensive.
Okay. Next question. Regarding SOSA, Steve, and actually I know all three of you have, your companies are heavily involved in the SOSA, so this one's kind of, I think, anyone you want to talk about it, not just Steve. Regarding SOSA, why do you think this initiative is so successful in getting the services to work together compared to maybe past initiatives? Is it the enthusiasm? I've been to one of the meetings. It seems like there's a lot of enthusiasm among industry, and yeah, it seems like there's a lot of announcements that have been coming. I know Annapolis has a product ready to go, and others do as well. Who would like to take that, Steve or Noah? First one to speak gets it.
I'll give a first shot at it. I think there's a general recognized need in the industry for better commonality and better cross-vendor cooperation. So that's the kind of the nuts and bolts of it. But at an administrative level, for the first time, we're seeing that the armed forces are taking a seat at the VITA table. So they are fully participatory now in the writing of the standards. So that kind of buy-in is going to have a natural push in the industry to move forward with these profiles.
Noah, do you have anything to add on that? I know that was spoken to at an event you guys had recently, the importance of SOSA.
Yeah, so CMOS and SOSA are really sort of related closely to each other. You know, one's sort of kind of a follow-on on a different plane, so to speak. SOSA is sort of the details of the hardware, basically detailing the backplane profiles, really, where CMOS is a bit higher level than that. So they're really related and do coexist and have kind of related requirements. We're seeing a lot of interest. You asked if there are RFQs coming out. Yes, there are. And like Steve said, there's a lot of buy-in. And in fact, essentially, the Defense Department is essentially organizing SOSA. So that's great, to be involved in that and, help to drive towards technical solutions that really solve the problem. So you've got, people with problems in the same room as people who know how to apply the technology the right way. So it's great to see that sort of work so quickly together to come up with a good solution.
Anything you'd like to add on that, too? Curtis Wright, I know, plays in that area.
We're heavily involved, and I have been attending the SOSA meetings. And like I said, it's amazing the enthusiasm that you're seeing and that everybody's working together to define the interfaces. And I think the fact is that everybody is working together, that everybody feels a part of the ownership of SOSA. And I think that's why it's moving forward as well as it is.
Okay. And I know for upcoming events regarding this technology, I know both Annapolis and Curtis Wright Defense Solutions will be at the Association of Old Crows event in Washington, D.C., their annual symposium. That showcase some of this technology and their expertise. Where is ELMA appearing next regarding, Steve, regarding some signal processing for military apps that people can see you?
I believe we're sharing a booth with our partner, Interface Concept. I don't have the the event calendar in front of me for at AOC. We're sharing.
Yeah, that's right after Thanksgiving in Washington, D.C. Yep,
right.
I will be there too.
Beyond that, we're in 2019, John. I have to plead ignorance on that question.
Well, this one's coming up. This is 2018, but I think we'll all be there. And so look forward. If you want to see more from these folks, come to that event. And that brings us right to our time limit for today. Sorry we cannot get to all of your questions. Someone may get back to you after the webcast with more information. I want to thank Noah, Tim, Steve, and for speaking today, and Annapolis Microsystems, Curtiss-Wright Defense Solutions, and Elm Electronic for sponsoring the event. Please remember that this and all Open Systems Media webcasts are copyrighted and may not be recorded or used in any way without the express written consent of Open Systems Media. This webcast will be archived online today and be available for 1 year. There will also be an MP3 version of the event available. Thank you all for attending, and I look forward to seeing you in future Open Systems Media webcasts. Goodbye.